And good evening, and welcome to Shattered Lives. Hello, everyone. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice. And we here at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore, that's donnagore.com, or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget that if you can't listen live each Saturday evening from 5 to 6 Eastern Time, the show is always available on our archives within 24 hours or so. And you can listen to it repeatedly and share it with all your friends and neighbors. And that way it will help educate other people. And we're hoping that you always would invite new listeners. So with that said, I say good evening again and welcome to Shattered Lives. And welcome from my location here in Connecticut. And as always, I do have my very esteemed co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, the Myrtle Beach maven, my co-host, my co-pilot, and skilled marketing and promotions professional. Delilah, thank you so much for being here with me and sharing this show tonight.
Oh, I'm always happy to be here with you, Donna, and you've always done a stellar job of putting together the most interesting guests who have the most interesting thing to talk about, and tonight is no exception. And I'm really excited about this show. I think, you know, Tony Bosco has a lot to share with our listeners, and I think all of us have a lot to learn from her and her experiences.
Yes, I totally agree with you. This is a different type of show, and I think it's one that we need to hear. You know, just in the course of living, not all of us have even though we might have homicide in common or some kind of crime victimization, our experiences are always different, and of course our take and our perspective and the way that we cope, Delilah, I think are all very individual. And I think Tony is no exception. She's a very courageous woman in terms of all the adversity that she has dealt with in her life, but she has utilized that in very, you know, some unique and creative ways. So I'm going to bring her in just a minute. I'd like to make a couple of brief announcements here, though. Just want to remind people that we do have a number of opportunities, ways to give for our friend and colleague, Susan Murphy Milano, who has stage 4 cancer and no health insurance. But she is doing better recently with regard to her health, and that's a very good thing. ConqueringCancer.me is the main blog that Delilah administrates, and we keeps us up daily or at least weekly on all of the happenings. YourCaring.com is a fundraising site for anyone that would like to go there. And there's a new one called CafePress.com, and there's a number of goods there, such as mugs and T-shirts and pajamas, and there's a beautiful picture of Susan on there, so you could get your souvenir as well as buy something useful. And again, all of the proceeds that are coming in will go toward toward her expenses, and then in the future I believe she's going to be using them for some other very useful ways beyond her immediate needs. And I have to say that she just recently underwent a procedure yesterday, and I guess you could call it weight reduction plan. And I don't know, it seems like she may have a lot of energy after she lost something like 23 pounds of fluid, which is amazing. And she was able to write her own blog, so we're very, very happy to see that. And just another couple of quick things. I want to announce that there's going to be a vigil for in the memory of Billy Smolensky, and that's going to be in Connecticut on Sunday, August 26th. And I believe it's going to be in Naugatuck, and the public is invited. And if you'd like more information about that, go to www.justice4billy.com. I will be represented in terms of a reading and other types of things. And there are going to be, I believe there's going to be a butterfly release and a number of different speakers. And Jan, his mom, I have to say, is a wonderful advocate and heroine for all of the legislation that she's done in behalf of adult missing, particularly adult males. I am doing a number of things, both with working on fundraising projects. There's a number of new blogs in the hopper that haven't been published. And I'm, as always, I'm looking for new employment opportunities. So please do contact me, contact Delilah. And with that, let me just say, now I believe I'd love to introduce our guest this evening. And she is from Connecticut. Her name is Antoinette Bosco, but everyone calls her Toni. And I have to say she has a very remarkable background, both personally and professionally, as a mother, as a person of faith, as a journalist and an author and a homicide survivor as well as a suicide survivor. And we'll get into detail about that. So, Toni, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time this evening and agreeing to be on Shattered Lives. I think it's going to be a wonderful show. So welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be on your show and be very, very happy to talk to you and talk to all of your listeners, you know, about my life and how you come through a difficult life, you know. Maybe something I say will help someone who's going through a really troubled time right now, you know.
Right.
And so do you want to ask questions or do you?
Sure. Well, that's, you know, I think that we got some detail in our promotional post, but I mean, there's a lot more. Can you perhaps share, because I think it is pretty remarkable, and the era in which you raised your family and in which you grew up, it's a different time than now, and we might have a lot of younger listeners. So I want to let them know that, you know, what you went through is not what people do today. So maybe if you could give us some of your mm-hmm. early life background and, you know, talk about your marriages and your children, and then we'll get into some other mm-hmm. things.
Yes, I'm quite old. I was in high school when the World War when the World War ended, and then my father was the blessing in my life that God gave me for an Italian father back in the 40s. He used to say God made a mistake. I should have been a boy because I was too bright to be a girl, because so many doors were closed to girls at that point, you know. But he didn't have money because we were a good Catholic family, and my mother was having babies all the time. And but he told me if I could get a scholarship, he would do everything possible to help me to get to college, and I did, thank God, because that wonderful father that I had. So that was like first major blessing in my life, you know, that I had my Catholic faith, and I went to the Catholic college. I went to the College of St. Rose, which is in Albany, New York, and have an honorary doctorate degree from them, and my wonderful college. And that was, but then what happened was that I was Italian, and in those days, the Italian fathers had to listen to the grandfathers. So my grandfather called my father, and he was arranging a marriage for me. And I mean, I don't think people today can understand how that is. But my father
is that true? You were having an arranged marriage?
Absolutely. My grandfather arranged the marriage because next door to him there lived this man named Peter Bosco, who had studied 9 years to be a Jesuit priest.
Okay.
And he left the Jesuits and visited my grandfather, saw my picture, and said, "Oh, she's so beautiful, I'd like to marry her." So my grandfather, who couldn't understand English very well, said, okay, we'll do it. So he called my father. Well, so he came to visit at the house, my grandfather, with this Peter Bosco and me. I was such a good Catholic. I thought, oh, my God, he's studying to be a Jesuit priest. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be a Jesuit priest. They wouldn't take me because I was female, you know. So I just thought that this was what God was. I was very religious. You have to understand that. I thought this was what God wanted for me, so I agreed to it. My father never did, God love him. Even up to, I'll still remember, the day before the wedding, he said, Antoinette, I got to break it up. He's crazy.
And how old were you, Tony?
I was 19.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I was old enough. I was really old enough to get married, but, you know, I had finished college, you know, and I was fast on things, you know. But anyway, I thought that God had sent him, that he was a holy man. We'd have 12 children, name them after the 12 apostles. I was really stupidly that young religious, you know what I mean? So, but I didn't know that he had been thrown out of the Jesuits. I didn't find that out for a couple of years, you know. And by that time, of course, there was nothing I could do. I had my Catholic marriage, and I was married to him, and I had, you know, I had a baby every 2 years. I ended up with 6 that I gave birth to, but the one good thing, see, the way the Lord works in your life is that he got a job right after we got married. It was right after the war, you know, and anyway, but he got a job teaching school in a town called Cape Vincent, New York, which is up near the Thousand Islands, you know, quite isolated. And
right.
And that's where we moved. And there, one day I went to the post office and I saw this kid who was ragged, and he looked like he was starving, and I'm nosy, you know. Everybody else was paying no attention to him, but I paid attention to him, and I said to him,
what
I said,
"What was he doing here? What was he doing?"
Well, he was trying to stay warm because it was cold. That was upstate New York, and even though it was November, it was already very cold. And I said to him, I asked him his name. He said it was Sterling, and then I looked at him, and I said, "Are you hungry?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I just baked a cake. I live 2 doors away." I said, "Come on over to my house, and I'll give you a big piece of cake." And his eyes just shone, you know. So I brought him, and then I drove him back to where, if you ever saw, it was a barren farm acreage, and the house was falling apart, and he lived there alone. And his mother once a week would bring him a lot of tuna fish. That's all the kid ate. I mean, I couldn't leave him there, so I brought him home with me. He was 15. I thought he was about 10, 12, you know, but he was 15.
Lived on his own.
Right. His name was Sterling. And anyway, the long and short of this story is that with the help of the Catholic priest that was there, it was a very small town, but the Catholic priest and I had become good friends. And with his help, we got a lawyer, and I said, "You got to stay with me. You're going to be my son. I'm going to take care of you." And my ex-husband agreed to it. That was good. He agreed to it, and we legally adopted him, and that was my son Sterling. And he turned out to be the most marvelous son. And now this is an interesting side of the story, is that my ex-husband kept losing jobs. So he lost his job, and I found him a job in Syracuse, New York, because I had some friends there. And we and where we moved, the Catholic church that was not too far away, there was a school. So I went walking over to the school, and there was the nun there, and I said, "Can I speak to the principal?" And she said, "What about?" I said, "It's about getting a young boy into your school." And the principal walked out. Now, do you believe this, the way the Lord works? We jumped into each other's arms. She had been my English teacher in Albany, New York.
You're kidding. Oh, my goodness.
No. Sister of St. Joseph.
She was able to enroll him?
She enrolled him, and he had the happiest high school years. We were only there for 2 years, which is all he needed because he was already going into that. And Sterling, unfortunately, he had this heart condition and had him, but he made it to be 68. When I first adopted him, they told me he wouldn't make it until he was 25 even, you know, but he made it to be 68. And he was in the service. He met this wonderful gal, and her brother was a priest. Anyway, they got married. They had 5 children, and then they adopted 2 interracial boys. That's the family. And the family, a good many of them were visiting me here for four or five days just this past weekend.
What a wonderful story.
Yeah. So that was one of the joyful things of my life, my son Sterling. And you know, and I'm very grateful to God that it worked out that way.
I'm sure, you know, and then, you know, I guess, you know, they say good, bad things happen to good people as well, and I don't know, but, you know, a lot of us have had, you know, at least some tragedy in our life, but we try to, you know, cope with it the best we can. I know that, you know, maybe we could give a brief overview of the couple of types of adversity that you have dealt with in the, you know, since that time.
I can do that pretty quickly. I can do it pretty quickly. Yes.
Sure, okay.
I have the the saddest thing. My son John, who was the second child I had by birth, my second birth child. He and his beautiful wife, they had just bought a house in Montana, and he was a woodworker. He was wonderful, and they weren't there any more than, I think, a month or so, a little more than a month. I hadn't even got out there to see them yet when I got a call from the sheriff out in Montana. They had been murdered. They were asleep in their bed, and somebody had come in the middle of the night and blown them both away. I didn't know for 5 months who had killed my kids, you know? And then it turned out...
It was very desolate, you know, like, you know, they're way out in the middle of...
No. It wasn't a desolate area at all in Montana. I mean, he had like about 2 or 3 acres, you know, but they had like neighbors, and I don't.
Uh-huh.
It was just like, who did this? And we found out, it was 4.5 months later when we found out that it was the 18-year-old son of the people from whom they had bought their house that stole into the house. Now, afterwards, when I had to go and clean up everything, I realized that he had stole a lot of things. I think he was sneaking into the house a lot and stealing things, you know. But
they didn't realize it, you know, at the time?
You know, I don't think so, because John was trying to set up his business. He was a carpenter, and mm-hmm. they bought the house particularly because there was the garage building that had was big enough to make into, a shop.
A workshop? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I don't know, but they thought it was going to be great living up in Montana, and because my daughter-in-law's parents came from North Dakota, which wasn't too far, so they thought it would be good, you know. But anyway, as I say, we didn't find out for 5 months, and then it was the 18-year-old
so
son
there
of the people.
An investigation, and then you said that you had to go and clean up the house.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You mean take care of the affairs and?
Oh, sure. Sure. Who else was going to do it? I went out with my sons, I went out with two of my sons. And, and by the way, talk about, this was only a year after my youngest son, Peter, who was really born mentally ill, had to be hospitalized a lot. He committed suicide. He managed to make it pretty well. At times, he joined the service when he was 18, and he served two years in Germany. And I thought he was going to be okay, but he came back and he was never okay. He managed to get to school, finished college, and then he just put a bullet to his head, and he couldn't handle life, and he left me a long note. You know, so we were in mourning. For Peter, we had just gone through all of that.
That's what I'm saying. What's the span of time then from Peter, and then what happened with John?
Yeah, about a year and a couple of months. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we weren't over our pain at all, because you never get over the pain of losing a child. And then I had to deal with murder. And we didn't know. We didn't know for 5 months, and then we found out it was the son of the people that John and Nancy had just bought the house from. And
was there a lot of like physical evidence? How did the investigation play out? Was it, you know, was it pretty obvious who the suspect was, or?
No, it was not. The reason it came out is that he was in a Quaker college on the West Coast, and he started talking to his roommate, and he told him, yeah, one day I did bang, bang. He took his fingers and made it look like a gun. And the roommate got so terrified that he went to the dean of the college, a Quaker college. You know what Quakers are? They're peaceful people. And the dean, I mean, then the next thing you know, they called Montana, and they found out that the police in Montana immediately realized he was the one who did the killing. They went all the way out. It was in California where the college was, and they went out there, and they brought him back, and, of course, he confessed, and they found the gun. They found everything, you know. And then he was facing a death penalty. Well, my children and I have never believed in the death penalty. We do not believe in killing. We believe in punishment, of course. I mean, criminals, they should be taken away from society. Society has a right to be protected, you know.
Right.
But we don't believe that they should
be killed. So all of your family members have the same perspective with respect to what kind of punishment should have been meted out to.
Yes.
Now, he had a nickname called Shadow or something?
Yes, they all called him Shadow out there. Yeah, Shadow Clark. Uh-huh.
Shadow. And
yeah.
How did your perspective on this, now, was it sort of an evolutionary process? Because didn't I read that, you know, initially, just like any of us, we'd be very angry and filled with rage. But then your feelings have come really full circle. And that's kind of what I find that's very interesting and definitely controversial. So, you know, why don't you talk about that a bit?
Well, because we were Christians and we never believed in killing of any sort. And I had never believed in the death penalty. I had worked against the death penalty as a lot in my younger years, you know. I didn't believe in it, that I believed in punishment. Believe me, killers should not be on the street. But
right.
I didn't believe that because they kill, that we should kill, you know. So when we found out who it was, my children and I, and this was, and it wasn't me suggesting it, it was actually my children even, they said, we will write a letter, Mom, to the judge, and we will tell the judge that we do not want him to face an execution, that we just want him to have prison for life. And that's what we wrote. We wrote and we all signed it. And I don't know if the judge was really paying much attention to it, but certainly Shadow Clark's lawyer was. And so he presented it with, by the way, the psychological evidence that Shadow Clark had something wrong with his head, you know. And
that's what I'm saying. Did he have a history with, you know, did he have a violent history prior to this murder?
You see, I never could get that information. They really kept it from me. But there was a reporter out there, by the way, whom I'm still very closely in touch with. The reporter was doing the story, and he kept finding this information for us. Thank God for him. And so he was able to get enough information so that we could go. In our heart and soul, we could go with the idea that he was really mentally troubled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we just didn't want him executed. We didn't want him to have to go into the prison. They had, by the way, they had just executed their first person in Montana. Montana brought back the death penalty, and they had just had their first execution. So they were getting ready to do that.
Mid-90s there?
It was 90. 90, right, okay. Correct. And they did, it was in 90, you know, all of this was going on when the execution, the first execution took place. And we just did not want that. We said, no, we don't believe in killing. And so we kept really our battle up to see to it that what he would just get would be prison. So I think he got a kind of life sentence because the judge said he would go to prison. And he will remain in prison until he's 60 years old. Well, don't forget, he was only 18, so, you know, and he's now 36 or 37, and he has a ways to go until he gets to be 60.
Had you not written that letter and expressed your views, would he have been eligible for execution?
Definitely. Yes, definitely.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So,
wow.
Yeah, so we really felt that at least we saved someone from being killed. And and even at that, you know, I mean, if a person is a little mentally ill, well, maybe they're not completely responsible, you know, for what they've done, you know what I mean?
Well, you've had that in your family, so you certainly know you can be sympathetic to that issue, you know. I wonder, Delilah, do you have any thoughts on, you know, what we've discussed so far, or have any questions that you know, you want to ask at this juncture?
I was just thinking that this goes to show you how very important a victim's impact statement is.
Yes. Absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The victims really don't have a lot of rights in our court system. I mm-hmm. think this is a fine example of how your wishes were honored in this particular case. And had there not been, you know, the ability to write the letter or to speak to this, then you may have not say so what happened to this man.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And it wasn't just me. You have to understand, with all my children, we all signed the letter because, thank God, none of my children agreed. They, you know, maybe because of, I don't know, maybe how I raised them or whatever, but in their own heart and soul, they felt as I did, that we should not be responsible for killing, any kind of killing. And so I was very proud of them, too, because we all signed the letter to the judge, you know. And,
right. I always say, in my particular case with my homicide, I don't know if I think I told you, my dad was killed in 1981 by a career criminal, and that they should enact the old chain gangs that they used to have instead of, killing people. That way they have to think about it every single day as they're breaking rock or whatever, and not watch TV or play basketball.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with that. I mean, yeah. I really, I wouldn't want them to be in there having a wonderful life. No. I think that there should be some difficulty involved with the life, so maybe that could give them some sense of what it means to be a good person. I don't know.
Did he say to you, did he make any statement in court, express any remorse?
No, but he wrote to me. I wrote a book called Radical Forgiveness because I'm very, very, I believe very much that forgiveness is crucial to the way we live as people and as a society and everything. But that doesn't mean, because I believe in forgiveness, that that you let criminals go free or people who do bad things, that you say, well, I forgive them and they can keep on doing bad things. Oh, no, I don't believe that at all. But in the book Radical Forgiveness, I had a chapter on this because I got a letter from Shadow Clark. He wrote to me, and he said he was so sorry, and he asked me if I would forgive him. He was so sorry for what he had done. And I wrote back to him, and I told him that only God can forgive, but that I would hope that he would do well and have a good life, and, in spite of all that had happened. And then he wrote back, and, I had we had about I think altogether three letters, and then I got I think it was the fourth letter I got that really threw me over the brink, because then he went on and on and on about he'd had a tough life, da-da-da-da-da, and so what he was asking me is, would I go to bat for him for early release? And I said, awful person. He was playing me like a fool, because I was nice.
And you didn't realize that at the time, yeah. Now, did he receive evaluation and medications, and therefore, his mental health status improved, or do you think he was just being manipulated?
I don't know. I'm not privy to any of that information. I haven't gotten it at all. However, his parents have they belong to a religious group that is not an established religious group, some kind of weird, to tell you the truth. I shouldn't use the word weird, but it's a religious group that is strange, okay? And they have twice so far tried to establish a whole big organization to try to get their son out of prison. And they've done this twice in the past year. And my son, my old
website, and asking for people to help and all that.
Yes,
kind of thing.
Yes, getting all people to try to write to the courts, the judge, and everything. My son Paul, my oldest son, he called the governor in Montana, and we have an assurance that that will never happen. They told Paul, you tell your family not to worry about it. That is never going to happen. He is going to work out his sentence. So if we get the word again, oh, and yes, and about 2 months ago, I got a letter from a minister, and it's a strange religion. It's not any religion that I've ever heard of that they belong to, right? Yeah, and he wrote to me about what wonderful people they are, what good people they are, da-da-da-da, and that I should be working with them to help get their son out of prison, obviously. Okay. I did not answer the letter. I'm in close touch with a wonderful woman lawyer from Montana. And anytime
I
have,
are you getting legal advice about how to handle this?
Yes. Anytime I have a problem like this, all I have to do is call her, and she takes care of it for me. And so I just really have been so fortunate to have her and to have my children. You know, so God is good to me. God is good. And,
can you tell us how did you start writing your number of 7 books? Was it after the murder that you became so prolific?
I started writing in 1952, and so I was already an established writer by the end of the 50s, and then I got a job with a brand new Catholic paper starting up on Long Island after they had split Long Island as a separate diocese from the Brooklyn diocese and became the Long Island Catholic diocese, and they started a newspaper there. And of course, I was already well known because I had been writing a lot, especially for the Catholic press. And so I was immediately given a job. I had just moved to Long Island. I was immediately given the job to be the woman's editor of that paper, and I stayed with them for 10 years. And wonderful, wonderful people. And it was during Vatican II.
How easy was that for a woman to become an editor in that era? I'm just wondering.
Especially someone who at that time had 5 kids, you know.
Yes.
Right. Well, they knew my work, and also I worked day and night. I mean, I never got more than 3 hours sleep a night for decades, you know, raising the kids and doing everything I had to do. And but God was good. He gave me the energy, you know, that I needed. You know, and the marriage was really, really gone. But he never worked. I mean, he couldn't work, and
I don't know if we explained this to the audience, but did your husband have a history of mental illness? Is that why he couldn't hold his jobs and whatnot?
No, I would suppose it was a kind of mental illness. No, it wasn't that. Basically, he just liked to get around and talk to anybody who would listen. He didn't want to work. He just wanted to be taken care of. I don't know what they did in the Jesuits. I'm sure that the other Jesuits weren't like him, but
he was lazy, huh?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely expected to be taken care of. And he, you know, he would even do when I started writing in the 50s. He would go to the post office every day. We wouldn't get mail to the house because he'd have the post office hold the mail to see if I was getting anything from like a magazine or something like that. And then he'd open it up, and if there was a check in it, he would keep the check. I mean, it was like
very controlling. Abuse in some ways. Doesn't that sound like?
No, this is a terrible thing to say publicly on radio, but I was raising the kids. I pretty much left him, and he just invaded my house in the middle of the night. That's when I got pregnant with Peter, my son Peter, and. And of course, then he went back to, I can't tell you the story, but anyway, because it was terrible. But anyway, I got pregnant with Peter. I mean, like, I got pregnant. I was raising the kids, supporting them and everything, you know. So I'll tell you the truth. I was suicidal, you know. But the minute the baby was born and I saw him, you know, when you look at a baby, I want to tell you, your heart
melts. Right.
Who was helping
you at that point in time? Did you have any support or someone to turn to?
No.
Did you try to go to any type of agency for help?
Well, I did have, there was this, there's a wonderful priest who was the head of Catholic Charities on Long Island who was wonderful in helping me. And he did help me psychologically and everything. And he also helped me to get the a formal separation so that I could be protected, not letting him in the house at all, you know. And that kind of thing happened. That was I was so grateful for that, you know. And then my ex-husband, he was always running around, and there was one woman, she said she got pregnant. They went to Mexico, and he got a divorce. So in 1968, I was finally done with him because, you know, he got the divorce.
My goodness.
She said she had to get married.
Was he ever prosecuted for anything, any of these crimes?
Well, they are crimes, but they're not prosecutable crimes, you know. I mean, you know, some guy... Yeah. Sleeps with a woman and moves in with. I don't know,
well,
it's not that way.
Raping someone,
but at least I was done with it, you know. So I raised the kids. I supported the kids. I raised the kids. I got them all college educated. God was good to me. God was good, because I was able. I had good health. I was able to work day and night without much sleep. I wrote not just for my regular jobs, but I did a story on a wonderful man. His name was Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, and he had just started a new health sciences center at the State University of New York in Stony Brook on Long Island. And I did the story on him. He, like myself, had 7 kids, and he called me up after. He said, "Tony, you're the only one who understands what I'm really trying to do." And, you know, within a couple of months, he called me, and he offered me a job at Stony Brook at the university. And by the way, I already had my master's degree, you know. So I took the job there, and that was the beginning of my new life with my children, where I could really, really support them by one job and some extra writing instead of having to write day and night as I had to do before, because at least that was a regular salary. The Catholic paper couldn't pay me very much, but the university could give me a decent
salary. Can you tell us some of the topics? I mean, were they all the articles and books, were they all about your experiences with the Catholic Church, or what type of other things did you write about if you were writing night and day?
Well, while I was with the Catholic paper, it was always about the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And but I never wrote about myself, never. I just it was all of the material that was of importance in the 60s. We wrote a lot about the Vatican Council, you know, we wrote a lot about all of the wonderful things that were happening with getting I also did a lot of anti-war, because I was very opposed to the Vietnam War, you know, and I did a lot. That paper was a wonderful Catholic paper, and that's the kind of thing we did. So, and I did an awful lot about parishes. I really, really put the parishes on the map of what they would do, you know, and that was good. And then at Stony Brook at the university, I was with the Health Sciences Center, and because my degree, I told you I was a pre-med student, and my degree...
that you were a pre-med student, huh?
Oh, yeah. I had completed my pre-med studies. So I was able at Stony Brook. That's how come I got the job for the Health Sciences Center, because I had the background. I had a degree in chemistry. So, you know, it was – see, God is good to me. It helped me every step of the way.
And it was your father that said, "Oh, I wish you were a boy."
Yes, my father. And my father was the joy and light of my life, you know. And,
you know, I'm looking at some of your credentials here, Tony, and I wonder if you could tell me, it says that you received the Wisdom Award, sponsored by the Wisdom House Retreat and Conference Center in Litchfield, and then you're the recipient of the Walter Everett Humanitarian Award for, I think it's your advancement in, is it human rights? This is cut off.
Yes, it was working against the death penalty and human and being for human rights. Yeah, yeah. Those were a couple of nice awards that I got, and and then I got a couple of international awards. I don't mean international; I mean national awards, which were also very, very nice to get. Most of those really came when I wrote a book against the death penalty. And that was the Mary Noel Fathers put that out. And when that book came out, I did get an awful lot of invitations to speak in various states. I was probably in about a dozen different states in the country, and probably about a dozen colleges. And
what was that experience like? I mean, and how were you received?
I was mostly received extremely well, because the groups that would ask me to come and talk against the death penalty were groups that really felt that the death penalty should be ended. You know, not that there wouldn't be people coming who would be furious because they wanted the death penalty, but for the most part, the majority would be people who understood that maybe the death penalty was wrong. So, this wasn't fun either. But, you know, I wrote the book called Choosing Mercy, A Mother of Murder Victims Pleads to End the Death Penalty. And that book, I mean, you know, it was only the Marinol publishers. I figured, like most Catholic publishers, most of my books were Catholic publishers, you know. They never got noticed or anything. But, boy, this one did, all over the country. And
What numbers did you have in terms of sales or whatnot, do you know?
You know, I've never made money. I've never really made money at my books. But because they're Catholic publishers, you know. So I don't know how many sales they actually had, but I do know that I went to more than a half a dozen states giving talks. And, of course, in this area, you know, in Connecticut, I gave a lot of talks, and you know, it was okay. It was a good thing to do. It was a good thing to do because the reason for that was because I was the mother of murder victims. You know what I mean? If somebody else was talking against it, they'd say, "Oh well, yeah, you know, that's your thing." But I mean, the questions I got asked—you would not believe the questions I got asked.
Can you give us a couple examples? What would they ask you?
Well, they would just say, did you feel this way before the murders? Or did this happen after the murders? They were just curious about when it happened, you know. And I said, it happened. I said, somewhere back in the 1930s when I had an uncle who married an Irish gal. She was my Aunt Margie, and my Aunt Margie died. She went a little bit nuts before she died, you know, and I had asked my mother back then, what happened to Aunt Margie? And she said, her brother was executed in 1928, the year you were born, for a killing that he was with another kid. The other kid was very rich. He did the killing, but her brother, who was very Irish and poor, he got the sentence, and so the other one got off, and he got executed, and that's why my Aunt Margie went crazy, you know, and I couldn't believe it. And that, by the way, that's when I started reading all about the death penalty.
And
I was a teenager.
That's when you felt that was unjust. How old were you at that point?
I was about 14, and I couldn't believe it. We kill people. I knew that there were executions. I had never thought about them. That's when I started doing the research about executions. And we still had them. Oh, we ever did. We did have them, a long time. And I just thought it was wrong. Just plain wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you done work with other prisoners in the prison? Have you participated in, like, protest marches or those types of things?
Well, not exactly protest marches, but I have been to probably 15 prisons, and I have written to more prisoners than I could count. I have stayed in touch with the prison system, and I'm only now just starting to not do very much because I'm old, you know. I nearly died a couple years ago with an illness. I'm fine. I got fine. God said it wasn't my time yet, so yeah. But I have a sister who's 2 years older than me up in Albany who had to go to a nursing home. I have to run up and be with her quite a bit. And when all of these things come into your life that you have to take care of, you have to make decisions, you know, about what you can do. So I still – I write to the prisoners. I'm still very much opposed to the death penalty. Very happy that finally in Connecticut, we now no longer have the death penalty.
Right,
and,
we no longer
you know,
have it.
Right,
we
will. You know, really, yeah. So, you know, I'm still doing the work I can do, and I write to my prisoners. And
now, how do you, Tony? How do you go about selecting who you want to correspond with, or how do you get information on that, or do they, you know, how do they find you?
Most of these were prisoners that I met when I was in prisons giving talks, like at Greenhaven Prison in New York State. That's I gave several talks there. In fact, the last I just gave one about 6 months ago there again, I was and met a couple of the ones that were still there after all these years, but. The ones that I met in prison, actually in prisons. I'm not writing to someone that I haven't met, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's better to know that it's somebody I met, because you get a sense of somebody, you know? And
right.
And the ones I write to, they're fine. And I shouldn't say that. There is one. He's an Oriental prisoner in California. And I do communicate with him. I mean, I'll write back and forth. I he's a doctor, a medical doctor, so I don't know how come he ended up in prison. I never ask. I don't ask the question, you know. I just try to say, you know, stay faithful.
Are you suspect, such as, you know, the perpetrator that killed your son, about them trying to, you know, question your motive, you know, manipulate you like he did? How do you know that this is just... Yeah, that this is going to be worth your time, and they're not trying to take advantage of you.
No, well, I don't write to him anymore, because when I realized, when he wrote and asked if I would, with a long letter, and I wrote back to him, and I said, I really, really wonder how you could have written this letter to me when you know that I so strongly believe you must serve out your sentence, you know? Mm-hmm. And then after I wrote that, he never wrote back again.
That's a good thing. But I'm just wondering, with the other people that you correspond with, you know, you haven't run into that same situation with the other people that they're asking you for favors to do this or
do
that?
No, the ones I write to are truly people who want to find God and have found God, I think, for the most part. You know, I have about, four right now that I regularly write to, but they're very, very, I think they're very devoted to the Lord, and they never ask me for a thing, no. So, you have to be careful with anybody in life, you know, that you do meet, especially if somebody wants to sort of enter into your life in one way or another. You've got to be careful, always, you know. And I'm very... you know, I have been careful. I have been generous, and I have been very, very pleased and happy and grateful to God for the prisoners I have met that I believe are good people, and that I believe that in some way I've helped. You know.
Yeah. Do you think that some of your children, since they have such strong beliefs, are they going to carry on some of the type of activities that you have that had them, you know, when the day comes that you can't do it any longer?
You know, my children have been really, really good. My daughter Mary particularly, you know, she even came and talked with me a few times in New York. My son Paul, they actually came. They went to New York in Manhattan, in fact, and spoke against the death penalty in Manhattan. So they were with me on it, and they were open about it. And I do believe that they definitely will continue after I'm gone. And, you know, so I have four living children, and I think they will carry on.
How many did you, you had seven, is that correct?
I had seven. Three of them
seven.
Are gone, yeah. Yeah, Peter with the suicide, and because he couldn't deal with, he just couldn't deal with life anymore. Very sad. And he was the first, and then it was John and Nancy. And then my adopted son, Sterling, who they said wouldn't make it past 25 years old,
right,
made it to 68 and left that great family that he has. But the three of them are with God in heaven, I do believe. And if I didn't believe, I don't know. How do you live if you don't have a faith?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that's really brought you through a lot. But, you know, I'm wondering because our family had a neighbor that was had the experience of suicide. I'm just wondering, because I haven't had that in my family, can you tell me, what is the difference in terms of your grieving with respect to suicide and homicide? Is there a difference?
I think it is. I think homicide is harder to take, to tell you the truth, because homicide means somebody, you know, who came and deliberately killed someone who didn't want to die, who had a right to their life. And all. With suicide, you have to realize that there is something which is so painful to a person that's why they choose to leave their pain. They want to leave their pain behind. My son Peter left us a very long tape, very long message that he left us to help us understand what he had gone through in life from the time he was very young. And as I told you, I had him hospitalized when he was a teenager because he was already evidencing. I had him under psychiatric care all his life. But in the end, it was time to go home. That's what he wrote. It was time for him to go home. And, you know, I still cry over it, you know, but that was what he believed. That was what he believed.
Can we ask, was it a violent death, his taking of his life?
He left me a message. He told me where he could be found, and he put a gun to his head.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's how he did it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the policeman here in town who found him, because obviously they, you know, I had to call right away. And would you believe that he is still my friend after all these years? He
is
comes to visit me still, yes. He isn't. He left the police force, but he comes to visit me. Probably every few months he comes, and we have a little lunch together and everything. And
that's wonderful. You know, have you ever taken up the cause to speak to groups that deal with suicide as well?
Yes, yes, I have. I've talked with groups about suicide. Mm-hmm. And mainly the ones that come I'm not doing many talks now, because I'm too old. I mean, I've just done so many, you know, but most of them were parents. Though occasionally you would get somebody coming, to one of those talks and I would talk privately to them afterwards because it would be a younger person, you know. And I would know that it was somebody who had been thinking of it, you know. And and I would give my my card, and I'd say, if you ever want to talk to me, you know, call me. But don't, you know, don't do anything. That is a mistake, you know.
And did you have people respond to that often?
No one ever called me. Once in a while, though, I had a parent call, and that was okay. But, I mean, that was good. I would be glad to talk to them because parents, I mean, you just don't know what to do if you have a child that's suicidal. And these wouldn't be children, by the way. A lot of times they'd be people in their 30s. They would be people who had been troubled. And, you know, I'll tell you, hon, life is difficult. Life is difficult. And there's an awful lot of suffering out there Yeah, and you know, and it's not just the parents. The parents who have to deal with the child who's suffering, it's horrible. But the child who's suffering has it horrible, you know. It's the way it is.
Had you not had that tape recording, you maybe would have wondered, like you said, that was very helpful. And I think that's rather unusual, right? You said it was a fairly long recording.
It is a half hour. Uh-huh. I have it. I still have it. And, of course, I played it for all the children so they could hear. Because Peter was really telling us the story of his life and how from the very beginning, very young, he knew there was something wrong. There was something wrong. And finally, he just said it was time to go home. And I have to believe, I do have to believe that the good Lord took him home, you know,
mm-hmm.
because,
right.
You know, he was a wonderful young person. He was a he made it to be 27. I can always say, and he wrote 3 books before he went off. You know, I mean, I have his books. I mean, like that he wrote, you know, he was brilliant, and he was wonderful.
It sounds like you have, you know, you have an extremely talented, well, you're a very talented person, but you have extremely talented family as well, and you know, what a legacy. And we have just about maybe 5 minutes left of
mm-hmm.
the show, and I was just wondering a couple of things. Are you a fan of support groups with respect to either homicide or suicide or, you know?
Well, I did an awful lot of that. I mean, I really did a lot, and in different states even, support groups that would ask me to come, and
right.
I did. And up until 3 years ago when I got really sick, I was still giving talks and doing that kind of helping. And
right.
But then after I got, they didn't think I was going to live. And they never found out what happened. I was just deathly ill, but they didn't know what happened. My whole body was
right.
blown up like a balloon. And but anyway, then after that, because it took me so long to, I was still writing my columns, by the way. I still did my work, but I couldn't go out.
Wow.
And then I decided that it was time for me not to do it. There are an awful lot of good young people around. Who can do it. And so I write a column every month for the Fairfield County Catholic, and I put a lot of what I want to say into that column. It's called A Woman's Voice, and that's good enough.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, at your age of 83, what makes you happy these days? And I know your religion makes you happy, but is there anything else, and you know, that brings joy to your life? And also, just wondering very briefly, what kind of advice would you give our audience who are dealing with any of the types of adversity that
well, that gives a very long answer. First of all, I have 12 grandchildren, and I have a number of great-grandchildren already. First of all, the grandchildren,
yeah.
my own children,
yeah.
those, that's the happiness that I have. And my family, I have 3 sisters yet that are still, I mean, you know, I have, and I have 3 brothers, so I have family, you know. I have family, and that is so important. But I do my writing, you know, so.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really, it's reading. I read a book a day. I am
I am a
voracious reader. And and the writing I still do. I do my column once a month. And that is good. So, and I have a house to take care of. I still have my house. I don't have anybody. I do all my own work and everything, you know, to keep the house up.
Sounds like you have a very full life, you know, Is there a website that you would want to tell, or would you like to feature one of your 7 books for the audience before we close?
Well, the books are on Amazon.com, you know. So if you type in Amazon.com and, you know, and my name, Antoinette Bosco, they'll show you all the books I've written and what's still available. And you know what? That's the way to do it, because they get books that I've written way back even in the 60s. And they'll be really inexpensive because there'll be books that they get from libraries that are, you know, so that's one way to get the books and or to hear about me, you know, get more information and that's about the best way, I would think.
Okay, well, you know, that is wonderful. So I just want to say, thank you so much. You know, we've really enjoyed having you as a guest this evening, and it will be available on archives, and I will be writing a blog, and I hope that Tony, you and I can keep in touch, because I still think we have some things in common, and I think we should keep in touch.
I think so,
Donna.
Yes,
and we really appreciate this. And so before we go, I just want to make the final announcement to please do go to my website, DonnaGore.com, and ImaginePublicity.com for all the wealth of information, all the wonderful clients that Delilah has there. You'll read a wealth of useful information from a variety of professionals and people that have to do with crime victimization in many different endeavors. And please send your donations and your prayers to Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Delilah. And good night, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tony.